Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Bruce Alpert, Jill Robbins, Phil Dierking, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will have the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is Bruce Alpert.
In America, people accused of crimes can choose to have their case heard by a judge or jury. Legal experts say most people choose a jury, usually made up of 12 people from the community where the crime took place. Two recent criminal cases heard by juries were the subject of international news coverage and emotional disputes about their outcomes. In Pennsylvania, a jury deadlocked on charges that Bill Cosby drugged and sexually assaulted Andrea Constant in 2004. To deadlock means all 12 jurors could not agree on a decision. Cosby, now 79, was a beloved television and movie actor, writer, and comedian. But his reputation suffered when many women came forward to charge him with sexual misconduct.
At the trial, the jury was asked to decide only about the charges from one woman, Constant. She said Cosby had drugged her, making her unable to resist his sexual attacks. On Wednesday, a juror told ABC News that 10 of the jurors believed Cosby was guilty on 2 of the 3 criminal charges against him. 2 of the jurors believed he was not guilty of those charges. Like almost all criminal trials, Pennsylvania requires juries to reach a unanimous ruling. That means all 12 jurors must agree on guilt or innocence. A new trial for Cosby is likely in 4 months. The other case to draw major news coverage in recent weeks centered on the shooting death of Philando Castile by a police officer in Minnesota. The 32-year-old Castile was a school lunchroom worker. He was driving with his girlfriend and her 4-year-old daughter when they were pulled over by Officer Geronimo Yanez. The officer said he shot Castile because he thought Castile was reaching for his gun. Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, used her phone to live stream video on Facebook of her discussions with the police officer after the shooting. She said Castile had explained to the officer that he had a permit to carry a gun and was reaching into his pocket for identification, not a gun, when he was shot. The 12-person jury unanimously decided that Yanez was not guilty of killing Castile. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Bruce Alpert.
Native Americans are questioning the leading theory of how the first peoples in North America arrived on the continent. For years, scientists have been debating where the first Native Americans came from and when they arrived in North America. The scientific community generally agrees that a single wave of people crossed a land bridge connecting Siberia and Alaska around 13,000 years ago. This theory is called the Bering Strait theory, named after the waterway between eastern Russia and western Alaska. Yet some Native Americans feel that theory is too simple and culturally biased. The first European explorers to arrive in the Americas did not use science to explain the people they found. The explorers instead looked to the Bible. Christianity's holy book suggested that human beings were created around 4,000 years ago. Biblical tradition holds that all humans are related to the first man, Adam. That would include native peoples, whom Europeans considered as primitive or simplistic. Dominant science believed in a concept of superiority, said Alexander Ewen, and that created an idea that either people were genetically inferior or that there were stages of civilization and Indians were at a lower stage, he said. Ewen is a member of the Purépecha Nation. He wrote a book called The Encyclopedia of the American Indian in the 20th Century. Early scientists felt the primitives they discovered in the Americas did not have the technology to have sailed the oceans. So they decided that Indians had reached North America by some unknown land bridge. They found their answer in the Bering Strait. Ewen says that scientific theory has lasted to this day, even with new discoveries and technology. Yet, new findings suggest that Indians arrived much earlier and by using different methods. In the first place, it's simplistic, said Ewen. The people in this hemisphere were, and are, extremely diverse, more than any other place in the world. In the 1930s, scientists studied a number of bones from ancient mammoths. The bones were discovered in the American community of Clovis, New Mexico. Among them were several unusual spear points, which the scientists named Clovis points. Since then, tens of thousands of the Clovis points have been found across North America. Some have even been found in South America, as far south as Venezuela. This led scientists to decide the Clovis people must have been America's first peoples. They believe the Clovis people arrived about 13,000 years ago. Additional discoveries in the 1970s led some scientists to push back the arrival date. Archaeologist James Adovasio dated artifacts found in Pennsylvania's Meadowcroft Rock Shelter to be up to 16,000 years old. But other scientists criticized the methods he used to arrive at that date. Other scientists have expressed their ideas on the subject. In 1998, University of California, Berkeley linguist Joanna Nichols argued that it would have taken up to 50,000 years for a single language to split into the many languages spoken by modern Native Americans. This theory meant that America's first peoples would have arrived closer to 19,000 years ago. Geologists have said that it would not have been possible to cross the Bering Strait by land until 10,000 or 12,000 years ago. This led to theories that early humans might have sailed down the Pacific coast into the New World. In 2015, a Harvard University geneticist, Pontus Skoglund, noted genetic links between Amazon Indians and the native peoples of Australia and New Guinea. Yet a Smithsonian Institution anthropologist was criticized for suggesting Stone Age Europeans sailed across the Atlantic thousands of years before Christopher Columbus. In April of 2017, researchers in California studied crushed bones they say came from an ancient mastodon. Mastodons are no longer alive and were related to modern elephants. The researchers think the creature they studied was killed by humans 130,000 years ago. However, most scientists reject this theory because the findings cannot be confirmed. Some Native American tribes have their own beliefs of how their people came to the continent. Montana's Blackfoot tradition says that the first Indians lived on the other side of the ocean, but their creator decided to take them to a better place. So, he brought them over the ice to the far north, the story says. The Hopi people of Arizona say their ancestors had to travel through three worlds before they finally crossed the ocean, going east to a final new world. And Oklahoma's Tuskegee people believe the Great Spirit chose them to be the first people to live on the earth. However, few scientists seem to take those beliefs seriously. Joe Watkins, supervisory anthropologist at the U.S. National Park Service, says scientists are uneasy about the time references and possibility for more than one explanation. Yet, he does not feel the beliefs should be dismissed completely. I do believe most of them carry within them kernels of truth of use to researchers, he adds. I'm Phil Dierking.
Ability to regenerate or recreate missing body parts sounds more like part of a science fiction story than reality. But researchers are finding evidence that regeneration may be possible someday in the future with improvements in technology. They imagine using 3D printing to make a kidney for someone in need of a replacement. They also talk about possibly using bioelectricity to cause cells to build new tissue and organs. These ideas and others were discussed earlier this month at the World Science Festival in New York City. The presentation was called Forever Young, the Promise of Human Regeneration. Scientists talked about the future of regenerative medicine, which combines the body's ability to heal itself with progress in biomedical engineering. Danny Spencer Adams is a research professor at Tufts University in Massachusetts. He told VOA that researchers have found that bioelectrical signals can lead to cellular processes in frog tadpoles. He said, such signals may someday start the formation of nerves, muscles, and other body parts. This is the cells themselves using electricity to communicate, he said. In an experiment, a frog regrew one of its legs in 6 months. But scientists first had to make changes in the characteristics of the animal's cells.
researchers say they have a lot more work to do before the process can be used on human beings. They have to learn which bioelectric signals can influence the formation of which organs. Adams says it's better to regenerate that organ so that you don't have issues of the immune system attacking, the way we do now with transplants. The hope is that we'll be able to help the body create a better replacement, really, a perfect replacement for the person of exactly what they've lost. Jonathan Butcher is a professor and biomedical engineer at Cornell University in New York. He and other researchers have combined mechanical engineering with developmental biology to create working heart valves from 3D printed tissue. Children may get the most help from engineered organs or partial organs that can grow as the child does. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Andrew Johnson. Johnson was vice president under Abraham Lincoln and became president in 1865 after Lincoln was killed. His name sounds like that of an earlier president, Andrew Jackson, and also like a later president, Lyndon Johnson. But Andrew Johnson served in the years just after the Civil War. You can remember Johnson this way. He was the first U.S. president to be impeached. Andrew Johnson grew up in a poor family in the southern state of North Carolina. As a child, Johnson had little formal education. Instead, he trained to be a tailor. When he was a young man, Johnson moved to Tennessee, another southern state. He opened a tailoring business, where he made, repaired, and sold clothing. When he was 18 years old, he married. His wife, Eliza McCardle, was only 16. They went on to have 5 children together. Eliza McCardle Johnson did not come from a wealthy family either, but she was better educated than her husband, and she helped him develop his reading and writing skills. She also supported his gift for public speaking. Johnson's speeches were especially popular with workers in their community. They liked his criticism of the state's wealthy planters. The workers also liked his politics. At the time, Johnson supported measures that permitted slavery to expand across the country. He was clear in his speeches that he did not support equality between whites and African Americans, whether enslaved or free. In time, Johnson held many political offices: mayor, Tennessee's governor, state legislator, and member of the U.S. House of Representatives. When the Civil War began, he was a member of the U.S. Senate. Although he was a Southerner, he did not believe the Southern states had a right to withdraw from the Union. When the other Southern senators resigned from the U.S. Congress, Johnson stayed. As a result, most Southerners considered him a traitor, but most Northerners considered him a hero. By 1864, the American Civil War was 3 years old. The conflict was becoming increasingly fierce and bloody. That year, the states that remained in the Union held their presidential election. The president, Abraham Lincoln, wanted to win re-election and continue directing the Union's war effort. But he was not sure that voters in the opposition Democratic Party would support him. So he turned to Andrew Johnson to be his choice for vice president. Johnson was a pro-slavery Democrat. Lincoln was an anti-slavery Republican. In the U.S. tradition, presidential candidates do not usually choose someone from a different party to serve as vice president. But in this case, Lincoln's Republicans did. They called the Lincoln-Johnson partnership the National Union Party. Political leaders hoped Johnson would appeal to Democrats who supported the war effort, to workers, and to small farmers. The plan, along with several military successes for the Union, helped carry the National Union Party to victory. The swearing-in ceremony the following March, however, suggested some of the difficulties ahead. Johnson was sick. To feel better, he had a lot of alcoholic drinks the night before the ceremony. The next morning, he drank some more. When Johnson stood to give his speech, he appeared unsteady. He talked about his poor family and his simple beginnings. Then he spoke angrily about wealthy Southern planters who had withdrawn from the Union. He became increasingly confused. Other people in the crowd wrote later that they felt embarrassed by Johnson's behavior, and some Republicans began calling already for his resignation, or even impeachment. Those critics could not have predicted that in a few weeks, Johnson would be the president. A few very important events happened in the weeks after Lincoln and Johnson were sworn in. In April, Lincoln was shot and killed. Johnson took office as the new president. The following month, the Civil War officially ended. The Confederate States of America was no more. And that December, a majority of states approved the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That amendment ended slavery across the country. President Johnson, therefore, guided the process of reuniting the North and South and supervised the transition of many African Americans from slavery to freedom. That period in U.S. history is called Reconstruction. Members of Congress from the northern states had been thinking for a long time about how to carry out Reconstruction. The most extreme lawmakers, the radical Republicans, wanted to punish former Confederate officials and extend political and civil rights to African Americans. Johnson had different ideas. In the first months of his presidency, before Congress had met, Johnson pardoned many former Confederate officials. He also let Southerners rebuild their state governments as they wished. Those governments quickly passed laws called Black Codes. Black Codes restricted the freedom and rights of African Americans. They permitted white landowners to control African Americans' labor, much as they had when the workers were slaves. The laws were enforced by all-white police and militia. Radical Republicans in Congress, as well as African Americans, objected strongly to the Black Codes. When Congress finally did meet, Republican lawmakers voted for a measure to help and protect formerly enslaved people. But Johnson vetoed the measure. He said the bill would give the federal government too much power. Johnson's veto was one move in a political war between the president and many Republicans. In time, lawmakers got the upper hand. The Republican Congress soon took control of Reconstruction. Against Johnson's wishes, they succeeded in passing several major pieces of legislation. One was the Civil Rights Act of 1866. It recognized that everyone born in the United States, including African Americans, although not Native Americans, was a citizen. Another was the extension of the Freedmen's Bureau Act, the measure that Johnson had earlier vetoed. For two more years, the federal government was authorized to help people displaced by the Civil War. Finally, lawmakers passed a measure barring the president from dismissing any top officials without the approval of Congress. President Johnson ignored the measure. When he believed the Secretary of War did not treat him respectfully, the president ordered that man's dismissal. In answer, members of the U.S. House of Representatives voted to impeach Johnson. In other words, they charged him with a crime. It was the first time in U.S. history that a president has been impeached. But impeached does not always mean removed from office. The case moves to the Senate. There, senators act as a jury. They decide whether the president is guilty. Two-thirds of the Senate must agree to convict the president. In the case of Andrew Johnson, 54 senators considered his case. For him to be removed from office, 20 would need to find him guilty. But only 19 did. His position was saved by a single vote. Although Johnson survived impeachment, he was not nominated as a candidate for president in the next election. Instead, he returned to his home in Tennessee, then competed for a seat back in Congress. On the third try, he succeeded. Johnson is the first and only, so far, former president to serve as a senator. He did not stay in the position long, however. A few months after returning to Congress, Johnson died suddenly after suffering a stroke. He was 66 years old. Today, historians have mixed feelings about his presidency. Johnson's supporters approve of his limits on the federal government and belief in a firm separation of powers among Congress, the president, and Supreme Court. But most historians believe Johnson's Reconstruction policies were extremely damaging. They did not help reunite the North and South, and they extended the suffering of African Americans and the country's history of racial oppression. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.